It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You are listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
Yes. Hello, America. Hello. This is Bill Carnes, host of 2A Radio, the Second Amendment radio show. Website is 2aradio.com. This is the very first two-hour weekend segment of 2A Radio. For years, we are on Monday through Friday, our shows on various networks. And so many things in radio that a lot of people out there in the listening audience don't know. One of those is the vast majority of hosts of radio shows don't actually make any money doing it. I'm certainly in that boat. So it's all about getting out the message. However, I have sacrificed so much in my personal and professional life to get the show out there. I forced myself to switch to a two-hour weekend format, which makes so many things in my life so much easier. It's literally to do a one-hour show Monday through Friday. It's about 3 hours a day to actually do that. To do the research, get everything together, do the editing, uploading, all of that good stuff, at least 3 hours a day. For the two-hour segment, it's about 4 hours because the uploading and everything takes about the same amount of time, a little bit more research. It's about 4 hours out of my week rather than 15-plus hours out of the week, and I've gotten so much done this past week, it's been incredible. So I'm enjoying this, hopefully you will as well, the new two-hour format for 2A Radio. Of course, you can get all of the archives of every show we've ever done at 2aradio.com. Click on the archives link, and everything is there in a nice, well-formatted area. The ATF, which is officially the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. ATF, I think, is a... more along the lines of Agents Trafficking Firearms, I think is what ATF is standing for now, because of the whole Project Gunrunner. Now, you remember just a couple of years ago, as soon as the Obama administration took over and got their feet wet, they started talking about how 90% of the guns found at Mexican crime scenes originated in the U.S. Well, of course, lots of different investigative people. We here at 2A Radio, we uncovered it as well. It's really 12.5%. It's 12.5%, 12.7% actually, of the guns found at Mexican crime scenes actually originate from the U.S. Not 90%, as has been lied to the American public by our elected official, employees who are in Washington. Just a few months ago, a quick review of news stories about the Mexican drug cartels would, of course, continue to quote that false statistic of 90% of the firearms used by these drug gangs came from the United States. Well, State Department documents, cracked by WikiLeaks of all places, shows that the government has long known that the 90% is a lie. Of course they have. The ATF, the Agents Trafficking Firearms Organization, they've known it. They originated the statistic. Yet, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has quoted this misinformation in speeches. Even the president has propagated the entire lie. Not only has the false statistic disappeared, the entire Mexican drug war has gone the way of the dinosaur. Could it be that the scandalous ATF Project Gunwalker, an operation that allowed illegal sales north of the border to keep the story from the public conscious, could it have anything to do with that? Well, the leaked State Department documents, along with Project Gunwalker, paint a picture of an administration that is either exceptionally devious or totally clueless, or a combination of the two. The devious model shows an executive branch that is manipulating and hiding the information to make the United States an equal partner in the evil that comes to Mexico via the drug smuggling and drug cartel violence. Of course, the mainstream media, which has gone far from a covert to an operative support of President Obama, would naturally want to kill this entire view. The alternative view is almost as damning. The administration, from the very top positions, doesn't have control over its own bureaucracy. If the president is allowed to believe, that middle management created and implemented Project Gunrunner without the knowledge of the Attorney General or the Secretary of State, well, and yet the blowback from Gunwalker has international implications that have strained U.S.-Mexican relations. The alternative view doesn't fit the view that Obama is a hands-on, hard-working genius who carefully mulls over all contingencies with the perception of a logic professor. There isn't any middle ground, so to protect their candidate, the news media is saying nothing. The president's default position appears to blame America first, of course. Thousands of Mexican citizens have been killed during that government's war on the drug gangs, and repeated the 90% guns come from U.S. lie. We lose goodwill with the Mexican people when that sort of thing happens. And it's no wonder that some of them just plain hate the gringos. Allow a few thousand weapons to be smuggled into Mexico through Project Gunwalker is scandalous enough. The founding fathers believed that a free press was necessary so the citizen can be well informed about what the government is doing. By joining a conspiracy of silence from our mainstream media, that media is hiding some of the president's warts. But these are warts that need to be revealed. Why would Obama change the way he conducts himself if his mistakes remain hidden in open sight? In all likeliness, of course, he's going to have a strong candidacy in 2012. And right now, obviously, he's the front runner, being the only one to really announce. It's better for everyone if his mistakes become part of the public discourse, so he could potentially make any sort of positive change in his image for this campaign. Of course, from my voice to the ear of God, hopefully this is a one-term president. And this will be a presidency that goes down in history in a negative light in this country. Jimmy Carter, congratulations. You are no longer the worst president in American history. When we come back, we're going to continue on with this story. Because the U.S. is now admitting that Mexican cartels get military weapons from mainly South and Central America. So we're going to talk about that when we return. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, and you're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Irresponsible people have no business owning a gun or listening to this show. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
All right, guys. Welcome back from the break. Now, the U.S. is now admitting that Mexican cartels are getting their military weapons from Central and South America. So, here's a breaking story only reported by Central American media and Fox News. The most fearsome weapons wielded by Mexican drug cartels enter the country from Central America, not the United States, according to U.S. diplomatic cables disseminated by WikiLeaks and published just this past Tuesday by La Jornada newspaper. Inventory includes grenades and rocket launchers, necessary items for beating the Mexican military. This corroborates the LA Times report from early 2009 which cataloged hand grenades, grenade launchers, armor-piercing munitions, and anti-tank rockets. The U.S. still blames American gun owners by asserting that American guns fuel Mexico's drug war. Even Obama has asserted that more than 90% of guns recovered in Mexico come from the United States. More than 90%, he says. In statistics, the sampling error essentially means that a small subset isn't representative of the entire group. In 2008, Mexico confiscated 30,000 firearms from drug cartels. Out of this, they selected 24%, or 7,200, to send to the U.S. for tracing. Of these, ATF was able to trace 4,000. Of the 4,000, 3,480, or 87% of the 4,000, were American. So actually, the 90% of all cartel guns are not American. Okay? So, again, those numbers. 30,000 confiscated. 3,480 actually came from the U.S. So 3,480 divided by 30,000 gives us, I thought it was 12.5, 12.7. It was 11.6, in fact, percent. So 11.5% of the guns come from the U.S. Even lower, pardon me. So, and it's not even if they use the actual statistic of 87% of the ones that they traced came from the U.S. That's not 90%. So they're rounding up, and of course Obama says more than 90%. Actually, barely 11.5%. Why would cartels spend over $1,000 plus, and have someone go through a background check and smuggling risks from some good American for a semi-automatic rifle, when they can buy 4 to 5 fully automatic AK-47s for the same price on the black market from something coming from Central and South America? Well, there's 5 key accusations against the ATF and Department of Justice made by ATF whistleblowers and other sources dealing with Project Gunwalker. The first, number one, that they instructed U.S. gun dealers to proceed with questionable and, in some cases, illegal sales of firearms to suspected gun runners. Number two, that they allowed or even assisted in those guns crossing the U.S. border to Mexico to, quote, boost the numbers of the American civilian market firearms seized in Mexico, and thereby provide the justification for more firearms restrictions on American citizens and more power and money to the ATF. Again, Agents Trafficking Firearms, ATF. Number three, that they intentionally kept Mexican authorities in the dark about the operation, even over objections from their own ATF agents. Number four, that weapons that the ATF let walk into Mexico were involved in the deaths of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry and ICE agent Jaime Zapata, as well as at least hundreds of Mexican citizens. How do you say at least hundreds? Anyhow. Number five, that at least since the death of Brian Terry on the 14th of December, 2010, the Obama regime is engaged in a full press cover-up of the facts behind what has come to be known as the Gunwalker scandal. Now, keep in mind, we know nothing about Barack Obama. Nothing. An authenticated birth certificate has never been produced. School records have been suppressed. He was supposed to be the head of the Harvard Law Review. Not a single paper Obama has ever written, none of his transcripts, none of his admission papers, have ever been released. They have all been squashed and disappeared. We have no idea who this man is. The only reason to have all of those things disappear is you're covering up the trail of someone where that information would not be good for someone trying to become president, or, in this case, sitting as president. Listen to the rhetoric. Listen to the speech. Hitler was great at giving speeches and rallying public support. Obama has the same ability, the same gift, if you will. However, yet again, as it would seem, used for evil. So it is not difficult for Obama and his handlers, who made all of his history, his entire life history, for the most part, disappear, to bring those same people into the government to cause all of this information to disappear. Every day we don't get clarification. These people are working and working hard like termites in a wooden plank to eat it and erode it from the inside out so there is nothing left by the time it's inspected. The ATF acting director yet again ignored a deadline request for last week for the Project Gunrunner documents. Ken Melson is his name. He's the acting director of the ATF. He's blown past a deadline for the delivery of key documents related to the Project Gunrunner inquiry, which was the deadline was about 10 days ago. It was launched recently by Congressman Daryl Issa, chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. According to the spokesman, to the committee spokesman, there was no response from Melson, who's also been dodging a separate inquiry by the Senate, Senator Charles Grassley, the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, Melson's name was also withdrawn from a roster of officials, including former Seattle Police Chief Gil Kerlikowski, now the Obama administration's drug czar, before a subcommittee on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by Senator Robert Mendez. That hearing, which began just about 10 days ago, concerns counter-narcotics and citizen security in this country. Sources familiar with the ISA inquiry indicated that because Melson was not forthcoming with documents requested by ISA in a March 16th letter, further steps may be taken. ISA has asked for specific documents relating to the genesis of Project Gunrunner, now believed to have allowed thousands of firearms to be walked out of gun shops in the Southwest and into the hands of Mexican drug cartels. The slayings of at least two federal law enforcement officers have been connected to such firearms, as it has been uncovered. On Tuesday this last week, ICE expanded his inquiry to include Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He's requested specific documents from her in a letter obtained by the press relating to a meeting held last summer in Mexico City involving former Ambassador Carlos Pascula and Assistant Attorney General Lanny Brewer and other unnamed officials. That meeting apparently involved a discussion of Project Gunrunner. Stay tuned, folks. There's more to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio are back.
And welcome back from the break, everyone. Again, this is the 2A Radio Show, and we are covering today the Project Gunwalker scandal, the ATF, Agents Trafficking Firearms, and the cover-up from the highest levels, from Obama down. Well, now, Representative Issa, who's looking into this whole thing, has been ignored completely, as well as Senator Grassley, when they have made official requests to Acting Director of ATF Melson, Ken Melson, to produce documents. Well, ISA has now been fed up. About 10 days ago, the last time he was ignored was the last time he's going to be ignored. He's now subpoenaed these records from Melson. Quote, you are hereby commanded to be and appear before the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, said a March 31st subpoena signed by Chairman Daryl Issa, which orders the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives Acting Director Kenneth E. Melson to produce and appear. The committee is requiring Melson to produce scheduled documents at the Rayburn House office building at 5 p.m. on April 13th. It's a few days from now. Included with the subpoena is proof of service and a schedule demanding, quote, documents and communications relating to the following. The genesis of Project Gunrunner and Operation Fast and Furious. Individuals responsible for authorizing the decision to walk guns. Any investigations conducted following the fatal shooting of Agent Brian Terry. Any weapons recovered at the crime scene or during the investigation into the death of Agent Brian Terry. ATF and the federal firearms licensees who sold weapons to Jaime Avila, the one accused of killing Brian Terry. A copy of the presentation made to officials at ATF headquarters in the spring of 2010, dealing with Operations Gunwalker and Fast and Furious. Operation Fast and Furious between and among ATF, I'm sorry, that whole thing was between all of them. Let's see, also, complaints or objections by ATF agents. And of course, all this information that is commanded to be provided to this House committee is followed with a schedule of instructions and definitions on exactly how they want it handled. At the Senate level, Senator Grassley says letting guns walk across the border breeds violence. A government which acts above the law undermines the rule of law. Now, this is actually written. What I'm about to read to you is actually written by Senator Charles Grassley himself. He says, watching revolutions unfold halfway across the world, Americans have countless reasons to appreciate living in the land of opportunity. Liberty, justice, and the rule of law are the foundations of our republic. These are the notable principles for which generations of men and women in uniform have put their lives on the line in service to our country. From the U.S. military to federal law enforcement, the taxpaying public places enormous trust in those who are leading our men and women into harm's way, whether protecting national security, enforcing our laws, or patrolling our borders. In the U.S. Senate, I have led a decades-long crusade to protect the public trust. Transparency and accountability are crucial cornerstones. My efforts to root out waste, fraud, and abuse aren't influenced by the political party running the show in Washington. Regardless of who serves the White House or which party controls the U.S. Congress, I am not afraid to investigate and track down answers if I have reasons to believe tax dollars are being misspent and wrongdoings within the federal bureaucracy is compromising the Constitution's covenant with the American people. Many of my investigations over the years have been triggered by information shared by whistleblowers. At substantial risk to their own careers and livelihoods, whistleblowers come forward to tell the truth about an injustice, fraudulent spending or wrongdoing. As ranking member of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, I have been investigating disturbing allegations that high-ranking officials at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF, gave the thumbs up for the sale of thousands of guns to known straw purchasers promising interdiction only to allow the guns to walk across the border. According to more than a dozen whistleblowers at the ATF, the Bureau knowingly has allowed assault weapons to be sold to these so-called straw buyers, individuals who illegally purchase firearms in the U.S., and then transport the weapons across the border to resell them to Mexican drug cartels. The ATF officials say the practice was intended to trap gun smuggling networks operating along the southwest border who supply the violent drug trafficking cartels in Mexico. The agents at ATF warned that the practice was headed for disaster. And their prophecy came through. Instead of intercepting the assault rifles and hand pistols, the firearms allegedly were allowed to walk across the border, without U.S. interdiction, delivering thousands of guns into violent drug networks in Mexico. Tragically, those who might have given the green light to the ill-conceived strategy may now have the blood of U.S. federal agents on their hands. In December, Border Patrol agent Brian Terry was murdered in a shootout along the southwest border near Tucson, Arizona. Two AK-47 type assault rifles found at the scene were among the firearms purchased illegally under an operation known as Fast and Furious. The murder of another federal agent in February also may have ties to this practice. Special Agent Jaime Zapata of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, was attacked and killed with a gun purchased by an alleged straw purchaser while on assignment in Mexico. In the U.S., if the U.S. government has allowed countless guns to walk across the border into the hands of violent criminals, the American public deserves to know. What's more, those responsible for the shocking violations of ethics and federal law must be held accountable. Finally, the family and loved ones of the agents who died in the line of duty deserve a full accounting and justice to prevail in the honor of their loved ones' memories. Since January, I've called upon the administration to come clean about its alleged policy that allows guns to walk across the border. So far, my requests for answers have hit a stone wall at the ATF, the Justice Department, Department of Homeland Security, ICE, and Customs Border Protection. When I ask about the allegations that ATF let guns walk across the border, the president said, quote, "There may be a situation here in which a serious mistake was made. If that's the case, then we'll find out and we'll hold somebody accountable." Well, the executive branch has the constitutional authority to execute the laws of the land, not trample on them. If the federal bureaucracy thumbs its nose at the rule of law and evades accountability, the violence along the southwest border will worsen the public trust. A government, especially a federal law enforcement agency, which acts above the law, undermines the rule of law. The end. Again, that was written in hand by Senator Charles Grassley. Now, when you have somebody in the Senate, or the House for that matter, in a position to be able to investigate, and the executive branch doesn't listen, that's a violation of the separate but equal powers, right? Three branches of government, everybody has their own checks and balances. That is a violation of the checks and balances. So, Grassley, I'm sure, is going to follow ICE's lead and start subpoenaing everyone. We'll be back right after this.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. So now this whole thing begs the question. Did the Obama White House authorize this gun smuggling into Mexico, this ATF protection racket? Of course, CBS News broke the story in February, where agents of ATF appeared to have aided and encouraged the illegal purchase of high-powered, all kinds of large numbers of firearms in the U.S., specifically in Arizona, in their gun shops, provided for the opportunity for otherwise illegal or really highly suspicious sales, and then provided a protection racket for these guys to run the guns into Mexico. Well, the Obama White House apparently channeled more than $10 million of stimulus money to support this completely illegal smuggling operation. A lot of money was made on this smuggling operation, and it's still unclear who authorized this apparent criminal activity and who are the recipients of the $10 million. Maybe the stimulus money actually filtered to these guys so that they could actually pay for the guns with U.S. dollars, and then the ATF run the protection into Mexico. We don't know. These smuggled guns were used to kill members of rival Mexican drug gangs, apparently some Mexican police and military, certainly a couple of U.S. agents, and innocent civilians caught in the crossfire. And let's not forget politicians who stood in the way. The excuse given by Attorney General Eric Holder and his Department of Justice for the apparent criminal activity was that the gun smuggling was somehow for the purpose of tracking illegal guns in Mexico. They couldn't track ones already there, so they had to provide new ones to track. And of course, they lost tracking once they hit the streets of Mexico. Guns were smuggled into Mexico and sold. Apparently, the serial numbers of the guns were recorded somewhere on the form 4473. It appears no satellite or other tracking devices were, of course, embedded on the guns. So how are they going to track them? Most of the guns simply disappeared as soon as they entered into Mexico and haven't been identified since. Of course, Project Gunrunner was started in 2005 with apparent bipartisan support, is what they claim now. The initial intent of the program was to stop smuggling of guns into Mexico. Sometime in the past couple of years, the nature of the program was dramatically changed. It's no longer clear who authorized these changes, and President Obama denies that either he nor Attorney General Eric Holder also authorized the gun smuggling for profit, keeping American weapons from getting into the hands of Mexican gangs is the goal of a program called Project Gunrunner. But critics say it's doing exactly the opposite. CBS News investigative correspondent Cheryl Atkinson reported on what she found. She said, on December 14th, 2010, the place, a dangerous smuggling route in Arizona, not far from the border, a special tactical border squad on a patrol encountered gunfire. When gunfire broke out, Agent Brian Terry was killed. Kent, Brian's brother, said, he was my only brother. That was the only brother I had. I'm lost. Well, the rifles found at the murder were traced back to a U.S. gun shop. Where they came from and how they got there is a scandal so large, some insiders say, it surpasses the shootout at Ruby Ridge and the deadly siege at Waco. To understand why, it helps to know something about Project Gunrunner, an operation run by the ATF, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms. Atkinson went on to comment about the implications of Project Gunrunner and the indictment. Project Gunrunner deployed new teams of agents to the southwest border. The idea? To stop the flow of weapons from the U.S. to Mexico's drug cartels. But in practice, sources told CBS News that ATF's actions had the opposite result. They evidently facilitated the delivery of thousands of guns into criminal hands in Mexico. CBS News wanted to ask ATF officials about the case, but of course, nobody would agree to an interview. CBS was unable to speak to six veteran, I'm sorry, they were able to speak to six veteran ATF agents and executives involved. They did not want to be quoted by name for fear of retaliation. But here's some of their allegations. In late 2009, ATF was alerted to suspicious buys at seven gun shops in the Phoenix area. Suspicious because the buyers paid cash, sometimes brought in paper bags. Imagine cash in paper bags. Great. And they purchased classic weapons of choice used by Mexican drug traffickers, semi-automatic versions of military type rifles and pistols. Sources told CBS News several gun shops wanted to stop the questionable sales. So they called ATF, but ATF encouraged the gun shops to continue the sale. Jaime Avila was one of the suspicious buyers. ATF put him into its suspect database in January of 2010. For the next year, ATF watched as Avila and other suspects bought huge quantities of weapons supposedly for personal use. They included 575 AK-47 type semi-auto rifles. Now, ATF managers allegedly made a controversial decision. Allow most of the weapons on the streets and into Mexico. The idea, they said, was to gather intel and see where the guns ended up. Insiders say it's a dangerous tactic called letting guns walk. One agent called the strategy insane. Another said, quote, "We were fully aware the guns would probably be moved across the border to drug cartels where they would be used to kill." Well, of course they would. On the phone, one Project Gunrunner source, who didn't want to be identified, told CBS News just how many guns flooded the black market under ATF's watchful eye. The numbers are over 2,500 on that case, by that way. That's how many guns were sold, including some 50 calibers that they let walk. 50 caliber weapons are fearsome. For months, ATF agents followed 50 caliber Barrett rifles and other guns believed headed for the Mexican border, but were ordered to let them go. One distraught agent was often overheard on ATF radios begging and pleading to be allowed to intercept those transports. The answer? Negative. Stand down. CBS News has been given at least 11 ATF agents and senior managers whose voices feared opposition to the strategy. "It got ugly," said one. "There was screaming and yelling," says another. A third warned, "This is crazy. Somebody's going to get killed." Sure enough, the weapons soon began surfacing at Mexican crime scenes. Dozens of them, sources say, including shootouts with government officials. The Mexican government was not aware of the gun smuggling sanctioned by the Obama White House Justice Department. This apparently has cooled the United States' relationship with Mexican President Felipe Calderon. Imagine that. The DOJ has at the same time tried to blame inadequate gun control laws in the U.S. for the gun smuggling. The gun smuggling into Mexico has been promoted as the reason to limit gun ownership by law-abiding U.S. citizens. So get this. It's not the law-abiding U.S. citizens that have been running the guns. It's the federal government that's been running a protection racket for people buying these guns and providing them with secure transit to Mexico to arm the drug cartels. It's not the U.S. citizens, folks. It's the government itself. It's stimulus money paying for all of this. As more information becomes available, we're certain that the implication of White House complicity and corruption, including that of both Obama and Holder, will deepen and become very clear. For the president, Obama is denying any knowledge that people of his Department of Justice were helping to smuggle guns into Mexico. ATF is part of the Department of Justice. The White House has been stonewalling the subpoenas of information on the gun smuggling. Well, here's something that Representative Darrell Issa says. He says, "The unwillingness of this administration, most specifically the ATF, to answer questions about this deadly serious matter is deeply troubling. He says allegations surrounding this program are serious and the ability of the Justice Department to conduct an impartial investigation is in question. Congressional oversight is necessary to get to the truth about what is really happening. Well, he's right. The corruption and criminal activity apparently sanctioned by the Obama White House is staggering. The apparent fact that White House ATF agents have been smuggling guns into Mexico and that the DOJ and politicians are using this smuggling as an excuse to place more restrictions on the eligibility of law-abiding citizens to own guns is both appalling and criminal. Can Representative Issa and others in our House of Representatives do anything to stop it? Can Obama and his administration be brought under control and made to obey the Constitution and our laws? Will Obama, Holder, and others be held accountable for this gun smuggling? Well, only time will tell. We're about to take a break, folks. We'll be back after the news break. And when we come back, we're going to learn about a former federal anti-drug agency director that thinks he knew that the Attorney General Eric Holder knew of Project Gunwalker. We'll be right back.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The two-way radio show with Bill Carnes is back.
All right, guys, welcome back. Continuing on, the former federal anti-drug agency director thinks that Attorney General Eric Holder knew all along about Project Gunwalker, and I'm quite sure he did. Here's the reason. Gunwalker started in 2005 under the Bush administration. It was continued, but yet completely revamped, turned on its head under Obama and Eric Holder's watch. You don't have one existing project or investigative named body in one administration and the other administration after 2 years doesn't know about it. It just doesn't happen. Well, about 2 weeks ago, Obama told Univision reporter Jorge Ramos that neither he nor Eric Holder had authorized the gunwalking aspect of Operation Fast and Furious, which is a smaller component of the larger Project Gunrunner. And indeed, he said that they didn't even know about that aspect of it. Obama, in fact, claimed to have not been able to have established who had authorized this fiasco, despite having had months in which to do so. Since then, recently retired, recently forced into retirement because of his objections to Project Gunwalker, ATF Mexico's attaché Darren Gill made clear that knowledge and approval of the operation went at least as high in the Department of Justice as Assistant Attorney General Lanny Breuer. He has one boss, Eric Holder. Congressman Daryl Issa seems to have doubts about Holder's lack of knowledge of the operation. As he told Fox News, he says, the ATF operates under Justice Department, and two assistant U.S. attorneys in Phoenix authorized virtually every wiretap, affidavit, and investigation conducted in Operation Fast and Furious. Some, like Issa, wonder how Holder could not have known about an investigation that size. As chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Issa has the power to investigate his suspicion, and he clearly intends to. Now a former director of the El Paso Intelligence Center, EPIC, a drug enforcement agency, DEA, affiliate organization established in 1974 to help with the interdiction of illicit drugs at the southwest border, is expressing his own suspicions about what Holder knew and when he knew it. Here's what he says. Former EPIC director Phil Jordan, however, is almost certain Holder knew about Project Gunrunner, even if he wasn't the one who approved it. Quote, the attorney general would have to be briefed. if not on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, Jordan says, because the program is one of a controversial nature. Quote, this program has been going on for some time. Well, that sounds quite plausible. Some of what Jordan has to say, though, was a bit worrisome. Jordan said he has no qualms labeling drug cartels as organizations that help terrorists, as Representative Mike McCall, Texas Republican, is proposing to do so. By labeling the cartels as terrorist groups, U.S. law enforcement agencies would have much more autonomy when it comes to chasing them down and attempting to capture their leaders. However, what that does now is it involves the CIA, and then the CIA operating in Mexico without Mexico's knowledge or approval. Now, while we're still trying to come to grips with the scale and the carnage brought by the ATF and DOJ and probably DHS and maybe even the State Department on Project Gunwalker, does anybody think giving these rogue lunatics more autonomy is a good idea? Then again, if this scandal goes as high as some think it might, the amount of autonomy wouldn't matter because the authorization came from the top anyway. So, we have a completely out of control rogue executive branch. The ATF has never done anything but to prove that it doesn't give a damn about the rights of the people in this country. Interject the Branch Davidian in Waco, Texas. They didn't care in the slightest what was going on. They tried to execute a no-knock warrant on private land with private citizens living in a religious compound. Okay? Well, these people were spooked, and they fought the ATF agents back, and they left. So then, call in the National Guard, call in everybody, FBI, ATF, certainly that, I forget his name, off the top of my head, that scumbag FBI sniper, what's his name, Asian guy. Anyhow, they bring him in there, and they seize the property. Yet they refuse to give lawful search warrants made on lawful statements for probable cause before they just launch an attack and burn a place down and all kinds of dozens of people die in a fiery death. Then introduce Ruby Ridge, where an undercover ATF agent sold a shotgun. Now, law says it has to be an 18-inch barrel. No. He sold a shotgun, which is called entrapment. 17 and 7/8 of an inch long. 1/8 of an inch short. And what do they end up doing? Seizing the property. Killing a mother holding her baby. This is the ATF. Now we have ATF behind Project Gunwalker. Literally providing avenues for illegal gun purchases and then protection for those guns to make it across the border into the hands of known criminals and known drug cartels who are in a fight with our ally, as it would appear on paper, the Mexican government and Felipe Calderon, the president of Mexico. ATF, DOJ, which ATF is under, they used to be under the Treasury Department, and then DOJ, and then back to Treasury. Now back to DOJ again. Ping pong battle, back and forth. ATF needs to be closed down. And all of their investigators transferred either to Border Protection or ICE or DEA. That's it. Just shut it down. Just shut ATF down. That should be easy enough. DOJ can have some lackey in every occasional FBI office in charge of FFL licenses and licensees inspecting those. It would save us untold tens of billions of dollars every year. An end to this. Stay tuned, guys. We're going to be moving on from this Project Gunwalker scandal after the break. Because now, anti-gun mayor Michael Bloomberg is being sued. We'll talk about this after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. Well, the biggest anti-gun mayor in the entire country is the mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg. Absolutely hypocritical SOB. Well, he's now being sued over the New York City's handgun permit fees. Keep in mind, owning a gun and protecting yourself is a right guaranteed by the Second Amendment of the Constitution, upheld in two cases. One in 2008, one in 2010, by the names of the Heller decision and the McDonald decision, respectively. That say it's a right. You cannot charge for a right. You can't do it. Well, a gun rights advocacy group sued Bloomberg this last Tuesday, claiming that the city fee for obtaining a home handgun permit was so excessive that it impinged on the Second Amendment. The group, the Second Amendment Foundation, based in Bellevue, Washington, is focusing on New York's fees because, according to the group, the city is one of the few places in the country that requires people to obtain permits just to keep a gun in their home. The city's fee is $340 plus a $94.25 charge for a fingerprint check. The fee in most other places in the state is $10, according to the Second Amendment Foundation. Bloomberg has long been a staunch supporter of gun control and has made efforts to reduce the traffic in guns into the city through sting operations, lawsuits against gun dealers, and other anti-gun measures. The city's fee for obtaining a home gun permit has long been in place. Again, we're talking about around $450. You can buy a gun for that, and this is the annual charge. The suit filed in federal court claims that the city's fees is so exorbitant that it, quote, impermissibly burdens the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. And the suit argues that because the city residents are forced to pay more than others, the fee also violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Last year, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the Second Amendment's guarantee of an individual's right to bear arms applies to states and local gun control laws. 2 years earlier, it applied the Second Amendment protection under federal law. In an interview, Alan Gottlieb, the executive vice president of the Second Amendment Foundation, said that the New York City fee had been on the group's radar for a while, and that the two recent Supreme Court decisions were, quote, cornerstones for future Second Amendment litigation. It's true. Here's what Gottlieb says. He says, we need those decisions to affirm that this right is protected in your home. That's what made it right to bring this lawsuit. This is an excessive fee being charged to exercise a fundamental right in your own home. A spokeswoman for the city's law department says the lawyers were reviewing the lawsuit. The Bloomberg administration announced nearly a year ago that it was moving to speed up and simplify the process for getting a gun permit and reducing fees for permit renewals. Why? Because of the McDonald decision. A spokeswoman for the state attorney general, Eric T. Schneiderman, who was also named in the suit, of course, declined to comment. The group also took issue with how the revenue collected from the fees is spent. Gottlieb says not one penny of it goes to processing the application. He says it all goes to the police pension fund. Seriously? the police pension fund? Sounds like a misappropriation to me. Here's another reason why Second Amendment Foundation and Alan Gottlieb are going after this law in New York. Very simple. Bloomberg is a billionaire. He spends millions every year, tens of millions every year of his own personal money to try to promote gun control and get the handguns and other guns, all kinds of guns, out of our hands. So for Second Amendment Foundation to go directly after this total jackass and nail him to the wall on his own anti-gun policies and his administration and the fees charged within that city of New York, this is to bring him to task and challenge him in his own front yard. Now, will this work? Something tells me it will. The reason is this. The Heller decision came first, June of 2008. And it gave direction to lower federal courts on how they are to adjudicate laws brought before them challenging the Second Amendment constitutionality. The McDonald decision 2 years later, June of 2010, just what, 10 months old now? That decision further incorporated the entire Heller decision to all of the states, counties, cities, municipalities, townships, neighborhood watch programs, everywhere, all the way down to the nitty-gritty. Again, with direction to the federal courts on how the laws are to be interpreted and applied. So will this work? It really can't not work. Because here's the deal. If it goes to the federal court, Second Amendment Foundation doesn't win. What do they do? Well, they're going to appeal. And they're going to appeal to, what is it, the Second Circuit Court, I think, is over New York. And if that doesn't go their way, then what do? They go back to the Supreme Court again. Now, the Second Amendment Foundation, in my opinion, does it right. The Second Amendment Foundation isn't nearly as invested in lobbying politicians, lobbying legislative bodies to get good laws on the books. What they do is they go after things through the court system. The court system is essentially the last answer. Once the courts say, okay, this is the way things are, that's just the way it is. Now, I say allegedly, in theory, I should say, the Supreme Court ruled back in, I believe it was 1913, if memory serves correct, early in the 1900s, that it was unconstitutional and therefore null and void any law passed by Congress that exempted the members of Congress from that same law. Now, Congress passes those laws all the time. Nearly every law passed, they would subvert something from you or I, is passed by Congress that exempts them, the members of Congress. And it's past members of Congress, current members of Congress, future members of Congress. Supreme Court ruled 100 years ago nearly that that was unconstitutional and those laws would not be, you wouldn't be able to affect those laws. But yet they still pass them. So that's why I say, in theory, what the judges say is the last answer. Now, of course, we have the McDonald decision. Prior to that, the Heller decision right there in D.C. And the city of Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, has still yet to effectively loosen up their gun laws the way that they were commanded to nearly 3 years ago. They're stalling. They keep, oh, we're working on this. Oh, we're working on that. And still, you don't have open gun laws there. So I guess I, as a normal citizen following the ruling of the Supreme Court, could strap on a gun and walk exposed through Washington, D.C. based on the Heller and McDonald decisions. And if I was harassed by the cops, they'd be violating my constitutionally protected rights as interpreted by the Supreme Court. Stay tuned, guys. They say, know thy enemy, so we're going to hear from somebody who writes about how the right to bear arms is an outdated idea. We'll go through this after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, and you're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back. So I'm going to read to you something entitled, "The Right to Bear Arms is an Outdated Idea." Of course, the author is unnamed in this. It was published on the internet, but of course, nobody put their name to it. I think it's just as chicken as you can get. The Second Amendment poses an unmistakable threat to the Republic. The 112th Congress must pass a bill to repeal and send it to the states for ratification. He's talking about the Second Amendment. Intended to promote well-regulated militia to maintain the security of the states, the right to bear arms has been interpreted by the courts as the right of self-protection. Yet as guns have proliferated, average citizens are left unprotected from gun violence. Okay, so you just contradicted yourself here, idiot. The Constitution gave the right to bear arms at a time when a standing army was considered a danger to the nation. Okay, so we're already blowing holes in this. Already contradicted himself. Yet as guns have proliferated, average citizens are left unprotected from gun violence. Because they don't have guns because there's unlawful anti-gun legislation on the books where these people live. And the Constitution never gave anybody any rights. He says the Constitution gave the right to bear arms. No. The Constitution protected the God-given right to bear arms. Let's see. Slavery was guaranteed and women forbidden to vote. Yet changes were made to structure a better society as the Constitution provides the means to correct outdated laws and reflect the evolving national interest. The self-evident reason of the United States exists are to guarantee indisputable liberties, foremost, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, founded on laws most likely to affect the safety of its citizens. These liberties are undermined by the inability of elected officials to respond to gun violence. The public has the right to change laws and exercise their right to protection from guns. You're absolutely right. And the way I protect myself from bad guys with guns, I'm a good guy with a gun. And I'm better with a gun than they are. Regulation efforts have failed as courts hold the Second Amendment to permit virtually anyone a gun, allowing 25% of the population to threaten the remaining 75%. Wow, how off base can you be? Unequivocally, people have the right to self-defense. However, just 1.5% of the population has used guns for this purpose, while over 23,000 die and 52,000 were maimed in 2010. Okay, now here's the deal. He's saying 25% of the population can threaten 75%, meaning 25% of the population owns guns, 75% do not. Where do you get those numbers? They're not cited. 1.5% of the population used guns for the purposes of defense. Where do you get this? 23,000 people died and 52,000 were maimed in 2010 due to gun violence. Where do you get these numbers? Cite your references. They're not cited. Liberals don't do that. As the police, as peace officers, are the entity democratically determined to protect the populace. That's what this writer says. Now, you are incredibly off base. We know that this writer knows absolutely nothing about what he's writing about. Because Supreme Court has ruled in the myth of police protection. Absolutely no government agency, including police, are legally bound to offer protection to any individual citizen. Period. You can be standing in your front yard, being beaten by a mob with sticks and bats, and a cop could drive by, and the cop has absolutely no legal authority. I should say, not authority, no legal constraints to have to stop and provide you protection. Ryder continues by saying, as guns proliferate, the police are often outgunned, with 160 killed in the line of duty last year. Excessive force by police is well regulated, but not that of the general population. Americans are no more violent than others. Europeans, where guns are regulated, still enjoy hunting and a tradition of marksmanship, but homicide rates are less than half that of the United States. Cite your references. The Constitution guarantees the nation's youth access to arms, but not the resources needed to compete in the 21st century. Really? He says 285 million guns in the U.S., but only 122,000 libraries. What? The youth have access granted by guns? Really? Where? Those truly concerned about representative government are better served by a computer and not a firearm. People have the right to the fulfillment of national canons, but to ensure domestic tranquility and provide for the common defense, liberty is not the right to own weapons, but freedom from violence. Really? How do you get freedom from violence when the ones who don't care about laws will bring the violence to you? This is what these ignorant leftist anti-gunners believe. That if you pass all of these laws, people will follow them because they won't have any options. Let me tell you something. It's illegal to steal a car. And more people than not have alarms on their car now. Cars get stolen every day. It's illegal to murder. Yet people get murdered every day. It's illegal to drink, get drunk, and then drive a car. But people do it every day. It's illegal to break into someone's house and steal their possessions and leave with them. But it happens every day. People that ignore the law don't care what laws are on the books. They're going to do what they're going to do. They don't care what the laws are. You tell them you can't have a gun. Most likely, they're prevented from having a gun right now in the first place anyhow. The laws aren't going to change it. So then the idea, well, let's just remove all of the guns from society. There'll no longer be any guns, period. They're gone. Nobody will even hoard any of them. They'll be gone. Gone. Okay, who protects us then? Oh, well, this person says the police. Supreme Court says police doesn't have to provide any protection. Okay. Who protects us individually? It's now going to be a collective protection where the police provide it? Do you think if you needed protection that the cops would actually be there, or the person that you need protection from is going to make sure that the cops aren't around when you're looking for said protection? What do you think? Again, it's just pure, sheer, total, unadulterated, absolute ignorance. Total ignorance. A response says, after reading this letter, my first thought was that the author had originally intended to have his letter published on April Fool's Day. After that, how else can anyone with a straight face condemn citizens from seeking to protect themselves when facing an armed and potentially dangerous criminal? I suppose the author's idea, in their ideal world, criminals may be friendly, unarmed people who never wish to harm anyone. But in the world that the rest of us live in, this couldn't be further from the truth. In England earlier this year, police officials were forced to warn residents not to install wire meshes in their windows because doing so could injure burglars
who frequently smash into unprotected windows in order to gain access to homes and storage units. While logic may appear ludicrous to some, this is exactly the type of logic the author proposes in his anti-Second Amendment letter. Let's hope that for everyone's sake, our social society will continue to value the rights of individual citizens to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back on!
And welcome back from the break. You know, politicians, for some reason or another, like the number 10. And the number 10 represents the maximum amount of rounds they want to allow you to have in any magazine of any gun that operates off of a magazine, semi-auto or otherwise. 10-round magazine bans. Everything else they call high capacity. I'm here to educate you. If you have a Glock factory magazine for a Glock Model 17, that magazine holds 17 rounds. That is a standard capacity magazine. If you have one that's for a Smith & Wesson M&P that holds 15 rounds from the factory, that is a standard capacity magazine. If in either of those guns, the law has limited it to 10 rounds, those are now, they're not standard capacity. They're now legislatively mandated reduced capacity magazines. And the 15 or 17 round magazine we spoke about a moment ago is not high capacity, it's standard capacity. The others are legislatively mandated, reduced capacity magazines. Connecticut is looking to do this. Well, here's some talking points for winning the gun magazine size debate. Now, depriving the public of gear as a way to stop murders is completely misguided, puts you at risk, and at its core, it's a thinly disguised effort to get to a zero-round magazine, in the false and dangerous belief that disarming innocent people will finally disarm criminals. It's never happened in history. Never. Well, legislators have asked to prepare a list. Here's the crux. By focusing on magazine size instead of ways to stop active shooters, you jeopardize everyone's safety. Hoping to limit murders by limiting the number of rounds in a magazine is irrational and hoplophobic. Hoplophobia is the fear of guns, the irrational fear of guns, as coined by Colonel Jeff Cooper. Now, why have people picked a 10-round limit? Why not 5 or 7 or 6 or 2? Are they saying it's okay to kill 10 people? Well, that makes no sense. Would you make police obey the limit? Of course not. Why not? Why wouldn't the cops have to obey it? Parity with the police. How about this? The public faces the same criminals that police do. Any restrictions for the public must match what the police can use. The public is always the first at the scene. And quite honestly, the public encounters armed thugs much more often than the police do. Because police are not the targets. The public is. If you can't justify impending the police with ammunition limits, you cannot legitimately justify impending the public that way. That needs to stop. What's needed to stop rampages is not another law written on paper, but speedier law enforcement or armed people who are able to respond right then and there. A criminal can't legally have a magazine of any size. A law restricting size does nothing. None of these arguments matter to the opposition. People who want to restrict magazine sizes are on a roll, using the Tucson assassinations as their momentum. They want any kind of gun bans that they can get, regardless of the crime-fighting, public safety, logic, whatever, for whatever reason. And these people are emotionally compromised. Limiting the amount of ammunition a person has for self-defense is dangerous. The only way to stop a lethal attack is with countervailing force. The correct response to a mass murder is not to restrict the public, but to empower the public and give us every advantage possible. People are always the first responders. Police are second responders at best. We face the same criminals. We both need the best tools we can get. We know that laws banning murder and armed criminals don't stop criminals and don't stop murder. Why would you want to do more of the same when you know it doesn't work? Because it's a hoplophobic response, not a rational one. Will magazine size bans feel good as if you're really doing something? Yes. Yeah, they'll feel good to those who want it done. Will they actually do something? No. We have 10 years of statistics to prove this on a national level. 1994 to 2004. Didn't make any difference. Infringing on the size of a magazine doesn't stop crazy people. Imagining that it somehow will, now that is what's crazy. An infringed capacity magazine violates our rights. Here's a reasoning. Will a magazine limit stop a murderer from carrying several guns or extra magazines? Of course not. Will it prevent swapping out of magazines? How do you propose controlling that? Infringing on magazine size has no effect on the millions of magazines already out there. Limiting the public doesn't limit criminals. It just limits the otherwise law-abiding public. Trying to stop crime or crazy people by limiting magazine size can't work. We tried that. For 10 years under the Clinton size, the magazine size ban. It's a proven failure. The New York Times admitted this is no uncertain terms. You can go to gunlaws.com/NewYorkTimesAndGuns.htm and read it. The public should have at least as much ammunition as the police can have because people face the same criminals police do. Honestly, we should all have equal gear. Attacking the rights of an uninfringed magazine because of one assassin is a political game, not a meaningful solution to homicidal rampages. Using a tragic homicidal assault for leverage against civil rights is absolutely reprehensible. Using tragedy to advance a political agenda aimed at increasingly disarming the public is the ugliest underbelly of politics, and it, too, is shameful. They say killing is fun. Someone has to say it. With constant Technicolor promotions of the thrill of killing from Hollywood and TV, we can expect another homicidal rampage. We must be ready to stop it when it inevitably occurs. Now here's another. They say they're not deranged, they're intimidating. Well, with Hollywood and the networks glorifying immoral behavior, portraying killers as heroes to be emulated, and mourned when put down, it's false to classify copycat crimes as mental disease. The proper response to the recognition that people can go berserk and cause mayhem is to foster a culture of marksmanship. From army posts to grocery stores, homicidal attacks take place in make-believe gun-free zones. Paper signs don't deter any murderers. A phony gun-free zone made by posting a sign may feel good, but is repeatedly proven to be incredibly dangerous and completely negligent. A person who posts a no guns allowed sign should be liable if it causes harm to anyone else. Murderous carnage has nothing to do with magazine size and everything to do with opportunity. Crowds of unarmed people in gun-free zones offer murderers a field day. If legislation really could stop criminals, there wouldn't be any. Because there's laws against every crime out there. Laws don't stop crime. Law enforcement rarely stops crime. It's time to broadly promote National Training Week. This year, it's from July 4th through the 11th. It's time to consider a tax break or tax credit to encourage people to go to the range and improve their readiness and their gun skills. They do it in Switzerland. Millions of 30-round and larger magazines are not used for killing. They're used at ranges, which is where most legal gun use is conducted. Attacks on magazines are attacks on ranges, the home court for the Second Amendment, the bottom line on legal gun use, and on an entire industry. Attacks on magazines are attacks on the heart of the right to keep and bear arms. Disarm criminals first. That's how I see it. Fear those in government who fear your guns, because all they want is to disarm you in an effort to further control you. Thanks for tuning in this week, folks. We'll be back next week.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com. I will not.